Welcome to Sri and Kira Live, the voice of passionate action, bringing fresh perspectives and timeless wisdom for today's shifting paradigm. Now, it is your moment to open your mind, relax into your body and spirit as we explore the greater meaning of your now experience. Bringing wisdom, laughter, and clarity, here are Sri and Kira.
Well, namaste, beloved ones, and welcome to a very special edition of Sri and Kira Live. Sri, I love this show because we're really looking about, is humanity ready? Are you ready?
Are you ready? Well, I tell you what, I've been ready so long, I'm re-ready.
Yeah, well, we won't go there today. And welcome, beloved listeners. We are just so excited to be with you today because today we really have one of our absolute favorite guests of all time on the show, Bill Burns. Bill is on with us every couple times a year. And every time Bill is on, it's fascinating. It's incredible. And tonight we're going to talk about, you know, is humanity ready? We're going to talk about contact with other life, government misinformation, find out what Bill's up to, which is pretty extraordinary. And the lines are open. So I just want to remind you guys that you can give us a buzz live, get in the queue at 888-627-6008. Again, that's 888-627-6008. And if it's busy, just try again after we take a caller. We also have a stack of email here, Sri.
Well, beautiful. So just for those of you that like a little background, Bill Burns, William J. Burns, is a prolific writer and has a PhD in medieval literature along with a law degree. How's that for rewriting history?
I'm hoping. Dynamic being, indeed.
and co-authored The Day After Roswell, which became really kind of a cult favorite. It was a New York Times bestseller.
Yes,
fact.
Yes.
But more recently, he was one of the co-stars and producers of UFO Hunters on the History Channel, which was very popular and suddenly came to an end.
Well, this is true. You know, I also want to say that as we talk about Bill is currently, he and his wife Nancy host Future Theater Radio every week. I hope you guys check that out. Stay in touch with Bill and find out what he's up to.
So let's just say hello and welcome to Bill Burns. How are you?
Hi, Sri. Hi, Kira. Good to be here again.
Oh, Bill, it's a delight to have you here, and welcome. My goodness, you know, we have so much going on, so much activity from our listeners. Let's just dive in, Sri, should we?
Let's do that. Let's get this conversation started.
Yeah, well, you know, Bill, I'm going to start with actually a listener letter, one of the ones that have come in. We had a lot of them that said the same thing, but I'll just read this one from Steve that says, "So glad to hear you're interviewing Bill Burns. I wish UFO Hunters was still on." So we just want to make sure we can't hear Bill and we can't hear the show. Are we here there?
Now? Yeah.
We can hear you now.
Okay, we're back. Yeah.
It's rainy season in Guatemala, guys. So it's our Skype, I'm sure, is causing this hiccup.
Well, let's back up because I'm all ears. Bill, could you catch us up a little bit on what happened toward the end of UFO Hunters?
Sure. Just to answer that letter, it was like an amalgamation, right, of a whole bunch of different things. One, of course, was that the show UFO Hunters was born out of the old UFO files that had predated it by about 10 years. And there had been an episode of UFO files called UFO Hunters, and it was profiling people like Stan Friedman, Roger Lear, people like that, Ted Phillips. These are all the very experienced, very scientifically based UFO researchers. And when we proposed the show UFO Hunters, it was an entirely different kind of show for history. It was brand new. And it came in at the same time as another show called The Ice Road Truckers. And the two shows were the most popular shows on the network. But one of the things that happened was that the budgets for UFO Hunters began growing and growing, and it was in the hundreds of thousands per episode. And that was really too much for them. And then History Channel spawned another channel called H2. So what they were doing was they were starting a whole other channel, and they were moving all their paranormal and spiritual and things like ghost, ancient aliens, all of that was going to this new channel. So UFO Hunters, the original one, was simply too expensive for them. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we got into a whale of trouble in the Dulce, New Mexico episode, where we showed that photograph of a human bovine fetus hybrid. And after that episode aired, three United States senators, Grassley, Graham, and Landrieu, submitted a bill, entered a bill in the Senate to make it illegal under Title 18, which is the federal criminal the Federal Criminal Act, under Title 18, to interbreed species genetically of animals and humans. And if there were a research project going on at Delphi, New Mexico, interbreeding humans and animals, and we know there were because there was the photograph of the mouse with the human ear, and there was all this experimentation, that made it illegal. So whatever pharmaceutical, biological, microbiological companies, genetic companies were doing this, suddenly it became a federal crime. And there was a lot of big money behind this because you could imagine using cows to grow human organs. And this was not new, by the way, Sri. This goes all the way back to that horrible creature, Josef Mengele, from the concentration from Auschwitz.
Well, I am fascinated by what's being said, and I'm fascinated by the energy. I just have to interject that I love that here we are talking about these things that brought senators in, that got Bill's show off the air, and boy, is the electric flying. It's just blowing up the lines.
We've never had this many.
Ever. All right,
but,
Bill.
But listen, I got a question
all
here.
All right.
So what I heard you say is they quickly passed a bill outlawing this researcher interbreeding of species. But how does that affect the fact that you were reporting on something you saw?
Because what they didn't want, you know, if you want to go chase a UFO and take a video of some lights flying over a mountain, hey, have a nice day, right? You're not stepping on anybody's toes. But you show that there is active human interbreeding going on. And this is during the time when you've got evangelicals screaming about all kinds of terrible things science is doing, but you've got big pharmaceutical and genetic company money involved in this. You're actually putting your hand in somebody else's money. Never do that. And so we'd gotten a warning that we'd absolutely gone too far with that. So that was the other kind of nail in the coffin. And then the third one was that what history wanted to do was stay on the safe side of UFOs, not on the cutting-edge side of UFOs. Don't go up to Area 51 and take telephoto lens video into the heart of the base. Don't go to places and say these are active UFO sightings. People are seeing these now, and here's the government. Don't get government informants to talk on camera. And all these things were not safe. Then, but at the beginning of the third season, they had what I had done is I'd written a segment for UFO Hunters on ancient aliens using our special effects guys, our prop guys, to build a flyable model of a Mesoamerican, they said it was a bird artifact from 1,000 years ago, but actually we think it was the artifact of a plane or a spacecraft or the space shuttle or something that might have traveled back in time. And the thing was, would it fly? Well, that particular segment in the beginning of season three was so popular. And of course, I had brought the guest on, Jojo Tsoukalos. He was my guest because we were friends. They basically turned that into a whole show. It was very safe. And so that was how Ancient Aliens, and they moved it from History Channel to H2 because it was so much, much cheaper to film. It maybe cost $25,000, $20,000 an episode as opposed to $300,000 an episode. So they could make money easier on that, and they still kept a nice audience. So those three things combined to really take UFO Hunters as it was being produced off the air.
Well, so there was a convergence of things there, but it's also certainly a statement about the consciousness of the powers that be.
Well, and what I'm fascinated by, Bill, is that, you know, you have such a propensity for being able to dive in and find facts. For me, really about, you know, at the end of the day, it looks like that what really these networks are caring still the most about is delivering entertainment for the economy of scale versus honestly educating the public.
Well, I remember, honestly educating the public would be the job of public television, local cable channels, things like that. I mean, at the start of the second season, one of the things that I had to do, we were looking for more sponsors. We knew the show was doing well. We knew the show was getting decent ratings by the end of the first season, especially after the Stephenville, Texas episode, because what I tried to do was navigate the show away from these tried and true older UFO cases into what's happening now on the ground, because the premise of the show was real people showing real evidence, telling real stories of UFOs they believe were real. So it was almost like UFOs Live was really the premise. And so one of the things we did was we diverted the whole show toward the end of the first season on the road to Stephenville, Texas, where there was a live series of sightings going on, especially some of the really credible. And so that really helped define the show to make it more immediate. And that's when the network began thinking, boy, you know, if you could turn the dynamics among the three UFO hunter personalities into the same kinds of dynamics on Ice Road Truckers, again, very popular, then you'd have something. And so what you're seeing is we came up at a time, and I'm writing about this now in the UFO Hunter, we came up at a time when reality television itself was undergoing a change from the standard four graybeards look at some architectural site and comment on the fact that, oh, human beings didn't have the tools to make this site. Actually, they did. But the human beings didn't have the tools to make this site, so it had to be aliens. So this wild speculation, and I agree with that. That's fine. That's fun TV. That's great. But on the one hand, we were moving from that. There was a whole new dynamic coming in.
We're having a
dynamic of Ice Road Truckers, of storage wars, of porn stars, of real housewives, of small people. And so there was a conflict.
So Bill, how does this feed into the books that you're doing now on UFO Hunters?
I know you're getting ready to do UFO Hunters 2, or you're finishing that. Is there anything new in that? Is it backstory? What are people going to learn?
Well, yeah, there is a backstory, and the backstory is how it was what I was saying. As we came up, reality television itself was changing.
Yeah.
And so we were caught at that watershed moment between the entertainment of three guys running around, you know, looking for stuff and doing crazy stuff, to this is really, we are really educating folks. And so there was a real issue about that, and they didn't know what to do with it. And that, combined with the high budgets, combined with where they wanted to move their UFO material, all that combined to say, fine, let's take a long hiatus. And so I'm writing about that, but I'm also writing about, in this book, really the process of trying to figure out what was going on, and the standard UFO shows, not just on History Channel, but on a lot of other channels as well, Discovery and channels like that, Sci-Fi, was you take an event or an artifact or something, right, a story, and you assert, like you're pounding on a table, this is definitely a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the opposite tack. I loved Sherlock Holmes stories growing up, and I went all the way back to Sherlock Holmes, the first Arthur Conan Doyle book, which is a story in itself, called The Study in Scarlet. And the process of Sherlock Holmes was you take every conventional explanation you can for an event, and you test it out as far as you can go for the purpose of eliminating that explanation as a cause. And what you're left with That's what requires investigation. And so that was the premise of UFO Hunters.
Mm.
So, well, it makes perfect sense. So you have a process of elimination. But, you know, my mind is still back at the grotesque mental image of the hybrid experimentation that you put on air. Did you investigate that further even after the show stopped, or did that just go away?
No, we did investigate it further. And what we found was really more astounding than there were aliens inside the Archuleta Mesa. What we found were a couple of things. One, this is from the person who was running, it's called BLT Laboratories, and they do all the chemical analysis, spectral analysis, and physics analysis of crop circles. And what they said was, first of all, the government was doing the actual cattle mutilation themselves because they didn't want to start buying up cattle for experimentation purposes, because that would have been in the world of the press, in the public world. Somebody would have said to them, hey, why are you buying all these herds? What are you doing? Why are you buying all these cattle? And they would have had to come up with a story. Better to say, look at the mutilated cow. We have no reason. We have no understanding. We don't understand why that's mutilated. Must be UFOs. So UFOs are a very easy explanation for anything you don't want to talk about, right? So that was on the one hand.
Yeah, right.
That's one. Two was, what were they looking for? They were, on the one hand, looking for signs of mad cow disease. Because the one thing we didn't want for our beef industry was there to be an epidemic of mad cow disease heading, and which takes 15 to 20 years to manifest itself in the public, running through the fast food industry. Can you imagine that kind of a debacle? That's two. Three, if you're going to experiment with hybridizing the species, you want specific lines of stock. So whether it's Black Angus or whether it's this, you want that. So you're not going to just buy up a herd. You will find these cows somewhere and just mutilate them. All you need is the soft tissue, and use that soft tissue for hybridization purposes, for stem cell purposes.
That is such a fascinating, deep subject, and such a huge discovery, you know, looking at where the show is going, what you uncovered, where it went. What we want to do is just take a quick break.
Welcome to the Self-Ascension Classroom, affordable and beautiful home study for your mystical journey. Imagine the gift of studying everything that you've ever wanted at home and on your time. Yes, it is possible, and there is so much to choose from as you dive into your home study experience. Remember that with every moment you spend studying this gift, you ignite your divinity. Imagine the mysteries of the Toheel and the crystalline clarity and radiant abundance of Avesa, a mastery balancing technique and certification process. And then cosmic life regression. Travel the universe and remember. Allow yourself the gift of navigating the inner matrix. This beautiful ascended mastery program of the Violet Flame will take you to places you may not have dared to dream to go. And then you will rediscover the true gift of your divine nature. Yes, the time is now to study the ancient mysteries, and it's so easy to begin. Discover the Self-Ascension Classroom only at SriAndKira.com. That's SriAndKira.com. Namaste. Namaste, beloved one. This is Kira Ra, and I am inviting you to take a journey of the soul in the land of the heart. Imagine your life free from chaos and filled with creative clarity. Imagine waking up each day in your private lakefront casita, greeted by brilliant sun, flowers, and birds. It is here that you will effortlessly resurrect your divine blueprint in pristine energy. Yes, I am inviting you to join us for a personal resurrection vacation retreat at beautiful Lake Atitlan, Guatemala. Here, you can rejuvenate your life as you indulge in Tosa spa cuisine, private healing sessions, yoga, tai chi, meditation, and loving support. Imagine enjoying pure air, zero noise pollution, and endless stars in this ascended nirvana. The time is now to claim your true joy. Learn more by visiting SriandKira.com and just click on the Resurrection Vacation Treat page. Tosa La Laguna, healing lives, healing hearts. We welcome you home.
The path of self-ascension is a conscious decision that brings your life experience into alignment with soul consciousness, the rare gift of an active approach to living in the heart and manifesting the present moment. Sri Ram Ka and Kira Ra invite you to visit Self-Ascension Magazine, a free online self-ascension hub that lifts your spirits and frees your heart to soar. On the Self-Ascension Magazine website, you can read Sri and Kira's perspectives on what's happening today, discover a daily meditation and weekly practice, watch special video and audio clips, follow Kira Ra's messages from the Archangelic Realm, and learn about upcoming events or courses. Relax and enjoy a visit to Self-Ascension Magazine online at www.SriandKira.com. Explore, participate, and unfold this rare treat for yourself. Remember, that's SriandKira.com.
Welcome back. We're delighted that you're with us now. And today we're having a conversation with Bill Burns, who has a long history of credentials and fun activities exploring life, life beyond life, I think.
And already we've just revealed so much on the show that my mind is going crazy. I want to jump in, Bill. I've got a letter here from a longtime listener, Doug. And let me, I just want to serve Doug in writing this for you. And let me just read this to you. He says, "What an educational show. I've been recording it for years. The last time Bill Burns was on your show, he spoke of, quote, the real reason governments are trying to keep a lid on the UFO and paranormal question. Now, that's a subject that I'm more than curious about. Elsewhere along the same lines, Bill says that, and this is a quote, that is the real fear of the government, that we have the power. So, Bill, I'm just curious. And here's something else I just want to share. He also sent another quote, which says, there is a shadow experience happening alongside this phenomenon, the misinformation campaigns used to challenge beliefs and stop us from discovering greater truths. Some are cover-ups, some are fabricated, and some are just part of a larger sequence of events to prepare humanity, .. for what?
Well, hopefully our connection will be good enough to get that to you.
Here's my take, and it's a two-part thing. First of all, I think that UFOs are part of a larger issue, that it's not just that there are otherworldly creatures that are interfering with our dimension, timeline, planet, you name it, okay? So it's not just that there's that. I think the larger issue is an issue of human empowerment. And let's say that you go back to, or we go back to a period before the development of human language, before the development of a human society, right? Before the Clan of the Cave Bear, okay? And at that time, human beings were hunter-gatherers. They were fruitarians. They ate all kinds of wild plants. That was their nourishment. And that opened up for human beings the idea that there was another reality besides the everyday reality inside the cave or sitting on rocks or things like that. But as we developed language, two things happened. Language, and Sri, you're a psychologist, and I'm going to get a consult from you in a little while. As we developed language, because of the ability to communicate, and other animals have this ability, it's not just human beings, I mean, wolves have it, dolphins have it, whales have it. Because of language, language breeds human hierarchies. There are certain, once you're able to communicate commands, directions, transmit information, convey information verbally, once you can do that, a whole bunch of things happen to your brain. On the one hand, your brain becomes specialized for language. You begin to develop hierarchies. Language itself, if you look at language, language is hierarchical. along with language, because that requires differentiation of the hemispheres in the brain, there came tool making and right-handedness and left-handedness. Once you have hierarchies, once you have societies, even if it's a clan, what you then have to do is exert control over the members of that clan. Language helps you do that. Once you settle down and are not a nomadic people anymore, you begin to develop, you begin to grow grains. You begin to become an agricultural society. Well, agricultural societies, growing societies, that all has to do with you are respondents to the change of seasons, your respondents to the tides, to the flood. You develop a whole bunch of other things. But what you also develop is a society that requires control. So it diminishes individual human empowerment and increases social empowerment. If human beings have certain kinds of abilities, we are intuitives, we are sensitives, we can project our thoughts, we can see the future, we are empathic creatures. All of that is diminished by language. So if somehow the paranormal, UFOs, bespeak certain kinds of powers that challenge the ability of governments, and I don't mean the federal government or the state, I mean any local governing body imposing a hierarchy on human beings, once that's challenged, that takes us back to a time before language, before social structures. And that is threatening to the status quo. And that's one major reason.
Well, you know, I want to jump in, Bill.
With language, we were able to command more people. We didn't have to fight individuals. We could persuade. We could bring people to perspectives. And that's what's happening is the perceptual centers of the brain are stimulating a responsive consciousness. You know, it's the basic activation of awareness. And with that comes temporal awareness, past, present, and future. Well, regardless of all that, we still have some wild card effects. We still have the X factor. Whether it's Sitchin's work that genes were manipulated, or the progression of people recognizing that their consciousness gets ever more refined and begins to see beyond the physical. The thing that we seem to be up against right now is that so much of what we call UFOs are actually interdimensional beings that fade in and fade out of phase with us. And I'm wondering if you'd had any instrumentation that would bring that to the left brain, or is this going to remain a theoretical conversation?
Well, what I think is that the instrumentation you may have, for example, what you look at is just from the point of view of extrinsic evidence. What you would look at would be, are there magnetic changes in the environment? Are there changes in the ambient radiation of the environment? Are there radiation, are there fluctuations in the photonic spectrum? These are all the kinds of things you would look at. And right now, we have some instrumentation that would show that, but by and large, we don't. And what we have seen in various, call them portals for want of a better term, what we see is the ability of these entities, call them orbs, orange orbs, yellow orbs, red orbs, to punch through whatever tissue paper separation there is between dimensions and almost explore ours and then go back. Yes. And then what if human beings do have kind of parts of their brain, say it's the pineal gland for argument's sake. Mm-hmm. What if they have parts of their brain that enable them to experience things from other dimensions, from other realities? And turning that on is also a big taboo for established governments.
Well, that's that. I mean, there's a whole argument that can be made about chemtrails and lots of other perceptions as to why. Well, yes.
Anytime you expand the boundaries, you rock the boat.
And, you know, this brings me back to the question I was asking earlier, Bill, which is, I find it fascinating that the NASA Library of Commerce Astrobiology Symposium just held about preparing for discovery a, quote, rational approach to the impact of finding microbial, complex, or intelligent life beyond Earth. And I find this fascinating that they're actually saying, okay, we're going to come together and start trying to let people know there's a possibility this is going to happen. I mean, the reality is we've found, what, more than 1,400 planets have been identified beyond Earth due to, you know, NASA's Kepler. It seems to me that the gap is closing, that somewhere we're heading toward that crucible moment of which all of this is going to come together. Are you sensing that?
Yes. On the one hand, we know that life on Earth started from microbial life forms, from basic organic-based chemicals that fell to Earth from meteorites. So spores are flying around space. We believe that there once was, at the very least, microbial life on Mars that when Mars was battered by meteors, broke off and fell into the oceans on planet Earth, and that began the life soup process here on Earth. So in reality, we are not Earthlings, we are all Martians. I mean, if you wanted to stretch that truth. But we're finding
or
stuff
beyond.
Yeah, we're finding stuff on comets. And I think we are being prepared for the discovery of microbial life or some kind of biological forms on Mars. And the Catholic Church already has said that if life exists elsewhere in the universe, it still falls under the same purview that it was created by the Creator. So you're seeing this intellectual embrace on all levels of life elsewhere in the universe, probably in our own
solar
system.
Well, and that's what I find so fascinating. Is that you're, and I love that you're saying this intellectual embrace, just like the subcontext of this symposium was a rational approach, thereby saying all other approaches may not have been as, quote, rational, and we're going to bring our left brains fully engaging this topic. You know, I love that you brought up the Catholic Church. The other thing they said was, you know, if an otherworldly being shows up, I'll baptize him. I mean, you know, which there's just a large presence that's starting to talk about this in a way we have never talked about it before.
But and still preserving their hierarchy.
Well, exactly. And so Bill, where does that bring us as far as misinformation campaigns, or are they now even changing those because the time is coming? It's not going to be able to keep denying things anymore.
Well, I think if there were a policy, which I don't think exists, if there were a policy, the policy would be let disclosure happen on its own. I mean, if you're looking for official presidential disclosure, something like from the White House, that already happened back in 1952 when Harry Truman said that what Washington experienced in July of 1952 on two successive weekends, he said, these are flying saucers and we know what they are. So that's the end of that in terms of disclosure. Now, everybody jumped in and said, oh, no, walk it back. It was just mechanical difficulties. But Harry Truman said it, and he said it in a moment of absolute candor because he was a very, very plain-speaking guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you know, on the net, there's reports of documents that were given to Dwight Eisenhower talking about the alien interactions and possible contracts with the government. And, of course, that from there we feed into all kinds of dark ops and conspiracy theories. The question remains, has the government been working with off-worldly beings?
Well, let me tell you a fun story that it's not fun. It's a fascinating story. It's going to be on my radio. It's going to be on my radio show Monday night, and it's a fascinating story about what the government may or may not know and why they're covering it up. This is a story that dates all the way back to in 1974. One of my co-authors, who was a radio host, he's the guy who exposed the hoax of the Amityville Horror, Joel Martin, got a news story across his desk. He had a radio show at that time about President Ford. It was 1974. President Ford, who was saying he would reveal the truth about UFOs. Now, this is an American president. Now, if you float back to 1966, it was Gerry Ford, then a congressman from Michigan, in response to the Hilldale, Michigan sightings, and people were actually seeing humanoid creatures on the ground, he wrote the Science and Technology Committee chairman in Congress, Mendel Rivers, to hold hearings on UFOs, and Congress did. Then when he became president, he said, I'm going to tell the truth. Well, this was in 1974, and the news media picked it up. Now, folks who know their UFO research history, scholarship history, know that the modern age of UFO research began in 1978 when Stan Friedman met up with Jesse Marcel Sr., Major Marcel, retired, who exposed the truth about what happened at Roswell from a first-person perspective.
Right.
Well, this was 4 years later. After, so Joe Martin carries this story. Well, the New York media dumps, this was on Long Island, the New York media dumps on him, you'd think that he had been trafficking with the evil forces of the world. That was how they treated him. Then Joe Martin is visited by some strange creature. He had a long name, human being, or so he thought, that told him to back off the story. When he wouldn't back off, the guy said, okay, look, here's where the material went to, and he gives him an envelope, a folder, and it describes the material and says it's at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So Joe calls the public relations guy at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and basically says, could you tell us what material got there? And instead of saying, no, no material got here. No, 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 you're off base. No, forget about it. The guy says, I can't talk about that, but there really is something going on here. Good luck finding the truth. I wish you the best of luck. How about that?
So that kind of sums it up.
And then 1 year later, Sri, 1 year later, there are two separate assassination attempts on Gerry Ford's life by members of the Manson family. I think Elizabeth Moore, Lynn Squeaky Fromm. And so years after that, now I'm working on the book Serial Killers with my writing partner at that point, Joel Norris. This was in the 1980s, 85-ish. And Joel interviews Charles Manson in prison. And Manson reveals to him that he was working for the United States government clandestine services, which was all working out of a place in San Francisco, an army base called the Presidio that became the Process Church. And so Manson is bragging how he and his folks were working for United States intelligence services, doing jobs for them that were off the books jobs, black bag jobs. And, of course, there were two attempts on Gerry Ford's life after he says he's going to tell the truth about UFOs.
Right, right. So you start connecting those dots. And of course, the Manson information is easy to discredit when a sociopath offers you memories. However,
absolutely, right. He's a sociopath. Possible. He's the embodiment of evil. Wears a swastika on his forehead. How can you believe him?
Exactly. Well, this is really when you talk about misinformation or really expanding the presence of doubt. Isn't that really what it's about, is to get people to doubt themselves to the point where they're even doubting what they're seeing?
Right. I mean, you doubt yourself because you always begin a statement about I saw a UFO is I'm not crazy. I know what I saw. Well, the fact that you've got to say I'm not crazy means that automatically you've been marginalized into the nut bin because you've seen a UFO.
You know, I just want to say to everybody, and Bill, I am crazy. and the reason I know is because normality is defined by a bell curve. And that bell curve has the edges. And somewhere right at the very thinnest edge is where I live. And I think so many people who are researching, who are expanding the envelope, could be called somewhat crazy. And without that, there is no expansion.
Well, you know, I think I go right back to, what did we do to Socrates? You know, what have we done to any of the great thinkers? What have we done to any of the great intelligent? And Bill, you know, I really count you among these extraordinarily immense intellectuals that has the ability to see bigger pictures. And it's a rare gift that you embody, and you've been able to touch so many aspects of that. So what's on your plate right now? What's going on with life after UFO hunters? I know you've got a lot of books in the works. What's going on?
Well, on the one hand, I'm involved in filming a documentary right now, and that's one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit, actually more than a little bit, because it involves this confluence of, let's just say, toxic spirituality, a toxic infection into someone's spirit. And I know that you are probably the experts on dealing with something like that. So that's on the one hand, with, let's just say, UFO portal, but you don't know what the UFOs are. Are the UFOs extraterrestrials? Are they interdimensional beings? Are they evil demons? What are they? And the history of this one guy's family, in which his biological father had kind of, in this Faustian search for the nature of knowledge, sought that knowledge in evil places, and wound up dealing with evil forces. And in so doing, I believe, affected, or better term is infected, the lives of a bunch of people around him, especially a very spiritually sensitive son, who has now grown up to be plagued by what he says are demons. I've seen some of the videos of this guy, some demons, things flying around his room. He's the subject of a UFO. He's the object, not the subject, the object of UFO abductions. And so we're doing a documentary getting, and I've seen some compelling footage already of craft. But what we want to do is set up a night shot, go to the place in the woods where this person says he's encountered these beings, set some cameras up so we can capture on video, and but at the same time deal with his own, I'm calling it a spiritual affliction. And, and it's a story, really, that I'd love to hear your comments on this story. This person had, when he was a teenager, a young kid, basically, he had a very bad concussion, and that affected his pineal gland, and they discovered a growth on his pineal gland. Well, you know, the pineal gland affects the flow of melatonin and serotonin, two opposite kinds of neurochemicals that control the sleep and dream cycle. So they control hallucinations as well. And so that's on the one hand. On the other hand, he was playing, never good to play with this, a Ouija board with some friends when he was younger, I think 12. And this is right about the same time. And the Ouija board, the other people took their hands off the Ouija board, and he had his hands on the planchette, and it spelled out this one name, W-I-E-W-D-A-W, Weedaw. And he said, oh, who's Weedaw? And then he felt some kind of a spiritual guide to a graveyard that was across the street from his house. And there on the ground, he saw the grave of this person, William Weedaw. Well, and here's the weird part about this. The gravestone was not standing up. It was flat on the ground. But the gravestone was triangular, like the planchette of the Ouija board.
Oh, interesting.
That's fascinating.
Well, you know, there's a couple of comments I want to add to the conversation. The two things. One of them is that the field of spiritual interference has long been discounted. You know, there's a book I read when I started to drift out of more conventional psychology. I believe the author's name was Modi, as an Indian PhD, and she studied the inmates in psychiatric institutions, looking at their drawings. And she made a very strong argument that over 60% of people with severe psychic problems, everything from borderline disorder to schizophrenia and other delusional disorders, that 60% of them or more were due to spiritual interference and demonic energies that had somehow been allowed in, somehow had infected these beings, and they were unable to cope with normal society as a result. And her evidence was quite compelling, and it launched me on a journey to move more under the fringes of the bell curve, and that was that there was a correspondence in the sketches of these patients showing these demonic beings, showing these energetic devices designed to inflict pain and torture and manipulate thought. And she continued to ask patients to make sketches, and people in different institutions drew some of the same beings. So that was quite fascinating. And you could say collective unconscious, you could come up with all kinds of perspectives to make sense out of it. However, the thing I know from our spiritual journey that Kira and I share is that the world of ghosts is quite real.
Oh, yeah.
The world of what we call the astral plane, the plane of disincarnate energies that are carrying consciousness, energies that you might say didn't go to the light and transmute.
Well, you know, Sri, this reminds me in a small way, Bill, I don't know if you're aware, but when I lived before, I always call it pre-Sri, right before I met Sri, I was actually on retainer for a chain of nursing homes in the Denver area, and I don't want to release who they were. And the reason I would show up is because they had so many suicides and so many people that were angry when they transitioned that they were literally stuck in the halls there. And I mean, you know, a lot of people would be stunned that they had a woman on retainer. And I would go into basements where the janitors refused to go because things were flying around, where there were people who absolutely didn't want to deal or interface with people that were quote unquote being possessed in certain rooms that they would put new patients in. And I can share with you for a fact that I have cleared at least 5 nursing homes of disincarnate energy.
It's quite a real phenomenon. And so this tragic person that you're describing, two things. One,
I see a lot of things, actually.
Yeah, there's a gift. There's a gift of that he is. Did you catch that, Bill?
I didn't catch the end of what you said.
Oh, okay. Well, what we're wondering now is that you're bringing forward the story of this young man.
We're ecstatic that you're doing this.
And we see so much truth in this story and in the hypotheses.
And he can break through this. You know, here's the irony of it, Bill, and you might already have discovered this on your own. Someone like this has great potential to actually not only heal, but become a radiant example of healing through that process. So when is this documentary going to come out?
Well, we're shooting it now. I'm hoping it's going to be out next year. But let me tell you the back of the other part of the story. So this person's biological father had this Faustian attempt to communicate with the dark side.
Yeah.
And he had this trunk of all these books about evil, these talismanic things. And this father was a really nasty, just a spiritually nasty guy. He'd been taken over, right? And he divorced the kid's mother, and then he moved to and this is a small town in northern Pennsylvania. So he moved to one place, but they were in the same town. Well, the mother married this really nice guy, an ex-Marine, who's also spiritual. He told me, I met him, he said, you know, I see ghosts. I see ghosts of people who have recently departed who communicate with me, and so they tell me they're okay, and so I know there's another world. I know there's another reality. So he's a very spiritual guy, and but he was a black belt guy. He was in Marine Force Recon, so you can imagine what this guy did for the military. So the father, the biological father of this kid, who's already had this spiritual experience, he goes to their house and he wants to give this kid a gift, and they're saying, no, we don't want this kid having his own TV. They have a big fight. So the father takes the stepfather takes the biological father out, beats the crap out of him, and the father goes away. And my thought is that what the biological father did, since he was into the practices of black arts, he might have put, even if it was unwillingly, even if it was not volitional, but, you know, his angry spirit put, I'll just say the word curse, on both the stepfather and his own son. Then, in trying to exert his controlling influence, he exerts control over this woman who's living with one of his old friends from high school. She falls in love with this guy. He doesn't want to fall in love with her, and he falls in love. But I mean, and he's trying to fend her off. But she basically is leaving this one guy for him. So the guy she's leaving, also not a guy who's in control of his impulses, kills the biological father. Okay, so now you've got a murder. You've got a love triangle. You've got guy practicing the black arts who's now dead. So there's now this gaping hole in that reality. Well, the kid had this person's, his biological father's box. That was his inheritance. This box of all this evil stuff, and he gave it to some, and he's looking for exorcisms, and he's looking for all kinds of things from the church, but there are a lot of priests who refuse to deal with him. Oh, I can, it's the policy of this diocese, we don't do exorcisms here, I'm not a qualified exorcist in the church, let me find you someone. So my thought was, talk to a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists have said, well, there's nothing I can do because in the DSM, there's nothing about UFO encounters. I can talk to you about paranoia. I can talk to you about schizophrenia. I can talk to you about borderline personality. But I can't talk to you about UFO encounters or interdimensional beings or evil. Can't talk about that.
There's a chicken or egg situation.
You know, it is a chicken or egg, and we're getting really close
so
to the end of the
my
show.
Thought. So this is what we're doing. So here's my thought. So this kid gave that box to a paranormal group that is quote-unquote studying it. So my partner Joel Norris, my partner Joel Martin and I have said, get the box back.
Yep.
Burn the box.
Yep.
Even if there's no such thing as spiritual evil, even if that box, the box is a totem. So even if all we're doing is making a statement about what would affect you psychiatrically as opposed to spiritually, just burning that box might be enough to convince you in kind of a Dr. Bernie Siegel way dealing with placebos that you're going to be healed.
It's
absolutely
a fabulous idea.
And I want to just kind of underscore that as we come to an end of today's show, is that there are indeed influences, whether they're from the outside or from our very own past, but these influences are like thorns in our energy, thorns in our psyche. And when we symbolically burn a box, when we literally burn an old photo or an old journal, we are saying goodbye. We are cutting the cord, so to speak, and it is a powerful cleansing. And I fully agree. And for all of our listeners, we have hit that moment where the show must come to an end for now, but I don't think our conversation's at an end.
Oh, absolutely. And we want to make them, and we're going to get in touch with you on that. And we're going to invite you back. We hope you'll join us again in December.
Okay. I'm more than happy to do that.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, now, and for all of our listeners, thank you for your patience with our lines being a little squirrely today. We hope you've enjoyed the show. I know I have. And we look forward to reconnecting with you again next week.
And we'll continue our conversation with Bill in December. But until we have the blessing of being with all of you next week, may you know that all is truly well.
Thank you for joining us at Sri and Kira Live. To have your questions answered, send us an email to guest@sriandkiraradio.com and check out more information at sriandkira.com. See you next week. Namaste.